outsiders.
Ah.
And there's for me just to get worth laying it on the strikers and all
yeah,
that kind of stuff.
Yeah, right, right. Trying to put the...
Where did you find it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I see that little thing there. I met them at close of day, coming with vivid faces from counter or desk among gray 18th century houses. Just keep seat face. I have passed with a nod of the head or polite meaningless words, or have lingered a while and said polite meaningless words, and sought before I had done of a mocking tale or a jibe to please a companion around the fire at the club, being certain that they and I who live where motley is worn, all changed. I don't quite remember that. Now this is what the revolution did to them. That woman's days were spent in ignorant goodwill, her nights in argument until her voice grew shrill. What voice more sweet than hers? When young and beautiful she rode to the heads. This man had kept a school and rode our winged horse, poetry. This other, his helper and friend, was coming into his force. He might have won fame in the end, so sensitive his nature seemed, so daring and sweet his thought. This other man I had dreamed a drunken, vainglorious love. He had done most bitter wrong to some who are near my heart, yet I number him in the song. He too has resigned his part in the casual comedy. He too has been changed in his turn, transformed utterly, a terrible beauty is born. Now, it's not a beauty, though. They've been wrecked by it. Hearts with one purpose alone, through summer and winter seem. You see, you think now the hearts that are enchanted to one purpose, it's going to be something fine. But he says, enchanted to a stone. Hardened.
Yeah.
To a stone to trouble the living stream. Just trouble the people who keep the offices going. The horse that comes from the road, the rider, the birds that range from cloud to tumbling cloud, minute by minute they change. The shadow cloud on the stream changes minute by minute. A horse hoof slides on the brim, and a horse plashes within it. Long-legged moorhens dive, and hens to moorcock's call. Minute by minute they live. That is, he just pictures the living stream. And then the stones in the midst of all. Too long a sacrifice can make a stone of the heart. When may it suffice? That is heaven's part, our part, to murmur name upon name as a mother names her child, and so on. But you see how it goes. And what he does, he sings the revolution, but it's a sad song. That's Yeats, and he was a revolutionary. But you see, he had this. You know, he could read Matthew Arnold when he was revolutionary. And Matthew Arnold said that the trouble with the romantic poets is that they wanted action, like Byron and Shelley, but they were half-baked. They didn't know what action they wanted. So Yeats, you see, during the revolution, could see what was happening. But he still was revolutionary.
Yeah.
So it's the right destructive thing. And you know, from the way we were talking, you see, you're interested in horses to get into the countryside, like Nick said. See, that's a little something that opens the mind, and they will see. And this other is so powerful, you know, that it's hard on you.
the sound, and you really don't know what the cause is.
That's right, you don't know what the cause is.
You don't have enough tools to work with, you know. I mean, you don't, you're the minority, and you're... I was talking this morning with my roommate, and we were listening to the news, and finally I said, Margie, just turn the news off, please. I said, I can't stand to hear it anymore. I said, I can't believe that the war is still continuing. They were talking about combat and all this other stuff, and I just thought, I'm just going to go out of my mind if I hear another word. And I was thinking about, you know, how everybody is just so wrapped up in their own world, and how nothing ever gets done, you know, and how many, so many people are being pushed around, and so many injustices are being done, and you want to do something about it, so you want to have a revolution because you want change and you want some type of justice to come about, but you don't have any tools to work with because the majority don't want it, and they're secure where they are, and they have this thing about, you know, well, the government's the government, so he's right. You know, the government's right. Well, I mean, nothing is infallible. Like I said before, you know, people just don't see that. They
well, you see, I take sides on some of these little small things like the Bart's Canal. And I get to the point where I can't sleep at night for thinking about that during Bart's Canal. Just putting millions of dollars in it, and all they just going to do is haul gravel. They ain't anything else to haul. Nobody ain't going to haul anything on those slow barges.
Yeah, well, my dumb entomology professor gets thousands of dollars worth of money for research on flashes of the fireflies, and here they have people starving in ghettos, and this creep is getting so many thousands of dollars to go look at fireflies flashing at each other. And I mean, and he is the most unsympathetic person you'll ever meet. And he goes out because he has absolutely no contact with humanness, and he goes out and watches fireflies and gets money for doing it. And here we have people that are,
you know,
dying of starvation, and he's watching fireflies. Everybody's,
you know,
sitting around.
You know,
who gives a shit?
I wonder if there's same one. There was an entomologist, that accent 70 over there.
Oh.
And that was that Thursday afternoon, which is the high point. And this little fella, I forget his name, but he was at the high point the whole week. And he was talking about what DDT did. And he took it through the chain. He took it one animal at a time, you see. And this entomologist out there, everything he said, he'd nothing for it. And, you know, he was stuffy.
Stuffy.
You know, we finally got rid of it. And you know what happened? One of my buddies was the man who did the sound. Because I had my sound out there at the time, see. So he helped me get my little microphone up there where his was. He got tired listening to that fella. He just cut off my microphone.
I know.
And the fella, I remember how he looked right now. He kept on talking, you see, and couldn't hear himself.
Well, my entomology teacher is just, he's amazing. I mean, I don't even see why people like him exist. He is just, I mean, you just wouldn't believe it. He sits there and he'll talk, and he talks about this firefly or this grasshopper or something with such, you know, feeling, you know, and then he tells you not to display anthropomorphism or whatever you call it, giving insects, you know, human characteristics, but yet he talks about them like they're some sort of, I don't know what, heavenly bodies or something, you know, and he goes on, and like, if you don't get it, if you don't grasp it, what are you? What, you are nothing if you don't get it. The other day, I didn't put something in a decimal fraction, or I didn't explain the problem correctly. I mean, I don't know anything about these things. I handed him my test, he looked at it, he said, and you're a college student? Like, Why do you go to this university if you can't do this? You know, why are you even alive? You know, he just looked at me like I was, and I thought, well, I said, well, you know, I can do some things. You'd be surprised. And he just, you're a college student. What kind of remark is that? You know.
All on the dividing line is a firefly.
Yeah. This man's crazy. He really is crazy. And he wants you to get excited about it, too. He really does. Oh, he wants you to get real excited about it.
You mean he evangelizes?
Yeah, sort of. You know, first of all, he'll talk about survival of the fittest, and he'll say, you're a biologist, they talk about it, they don't know what they're talking about. I'm going to tell you what it is. Nobody knows, but he knows.
Yeah.
It's genetic survival, not life or death. You see, these biologists, they go on and on and on, but they don't know, but he knows. And he's just, and like everybody, nobody, I've so many people I know in the department, graduate students that I talk with, they don't like him either because he's just really a pushy kind of a person, you know, and he's just got such a narrow mind, it's
and
unbelievable.
And you have to put up with him, and this one, that's too much.
I'm freaking out. I'm real.
I really,
it's another spring, and I'm going to be in the infirmary before the end of the term. And I'm going to fail entomology. I am failing all his tests. And he doesn't understand it. I went in to talk to him one day, and I told him, I said, Dr. Lloyd, I said, I can't identify these insects when I see them, you know. Well, you don't have to be an entomologist to identify these orders. Just looked at me like, what, you know, and I said, but you don't understand. I said, isn't it conceivable that I'm just not getting it, that I don't have the mind for it? That wasn't conceivable. Well, you can just come in here and look at my insects if you want to. Just pull open the drawers and study them. And I thought, oh, I've got time to come in here and pull open the drawers and study these insects. And he just couldn't, you know, he just wanted me to get out of his office, get out of his way. He didn't want to hear about it because there was no conceivable way to him that I didn't understand. And I went in asking for help. He tells you to come in. When you go in, he tells you, he makes you leave. You know, you're in there and he's putting you down so bad you just can't stand to stay, you know. And then what he'll do, there's this one girl, he did this on purpose, I know it, in the class, and she's real involved in this whole thing, you know, this entomology thing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's this one, you know, she knows what she's doing in the class. So when I handed him my paper and he made that sarcastic remark to me about being a college student, he was looking at her paper and he said, you're going to be back, I can tell. People like you, you do real well in things like this. You're going to be a first-rate entomologist. You're coming back, aren't you? You're coming along with us, aren't you? I thought, oh, God. And he just looked at me like, yeah, well, where are you going? And it was just,
I don't think any of the entomologists appreciated this pollution explosion, don't you know? But they talked about what DDT did, because they felt like DDT was sort of their contribution to the world.
Oh, shoot. It's just amazing. Well,
I hope they're not the only two courses you have.
No, I've got another bummer.
Another one?
I have. Do you know Dr. Bayette? He's a new English professor. You know Bayette, don't you?
I don't know the name.
Yeah, he's a new one. He's sort of a nice guy. Just that you're just sort of bored in this class, but he's a nice guy. He is a nice. I mean, he knows his material. He's a very smart man.
I've
got to be some philosopher
like
to be in his class, but he knows.
Oh really? Oh, he's
real smart.
He expects a good man.
Yeah, I think he does. I mean, really, I'm not just saying this to put you on. I feel comfortable in your class, you know. It's informal enough where I can, you know, take off my shoes, eat lunch.
Yeah.
Oh, I haven't. I've missed twice. You're mad at me because of Thursday. And you know it.
She can take off her shoes and eat her lunch.
But I mean, I wouldn't dare take off my shoes in Dr. Bayette's class, you know,
oh,
because
you wouldn't. I didn't know there was a professor on campus you couldn't take off.
Well, I mean, I would just be, you know, it's just sort of an atmosphere where the people are very intellectual, And they go off on these tangents about very deep things, you know, dimensions and space and time, and
yeah.
Like, I just don't know what to say. I don't say anything. I just sit there, scared to death.
Yes. Well, now you see, that is the order of the day.
Oh God, I don't see.
Oh yes, you've just got to be innocent things like that.
Watch. We've been talking about Ruskin and Arnold, you know, and. And,
yes, but it's not just mere old Ruskin and Arnold. It's Ruskin and Arnold in the light of all those.
I don't say anything. And you know I come to your class. Now that's not. Is he being sarcastic to me? I can't stand it. I've been out looking for another apartment. That's where I was Thursday.
I'm
getting put out. I can't afford the rent, and
I
was supposed.
Is this date?
Well, not right now, but see, I've got to be out of there by the 15th, and I needed right away to get another place because I was supposed to move into a cheaper apartment, and my plans fell through because the people that were supposed to move out of the house didn't move out. So all of a sudden, I went to my landlord and I said, "This is legality." And I said, I want to move, you know. And he said, well, you've got to stay here till the 15th or you lose your security deposit. And I said, why? I never signed anything. He said, well, the girl you're subletting from, her lease isn't up till August. I mean, till June 15th. He said, you've got to stay here. I said, but I talked to Janice, and she told me I could leave any time I wanted. And he said, well, you didn't talk to me, and I've got it right here in the contract. And I said, so I've got to stay there or else lose my deposit. So that means I have to stay there and pay a half a month's rent there, and then I have to move into this other place, which I found, which I was looking. I was out apartment hunting,
yeah.
And that's why I didn't go to your class.
So
you go within your class.
You and Miss Carl.
Yeah. And here I am now, working on your term paper all weekend long, devoting all my time to your class.
Yeah.
And it's Sunday afternoon.
Right. My term paper's going to be real good. Typewritten, 5 pages. How do you like that? I really have been working hard. It's going to be terrible. I tried to be intellectual. Tried to be scholarly, because on one of my papers you said I was not quite scholarly enough. So.
Ike
said, I figured that out today. I said that was, you know, from an experience point of view or something. That wasn't intellectually. He wasn't talking about it. See, I figured that all out by myself.
You would have loved those students who were out Thursday, and I never saw such revelation.
Yeah.
What happened?
I never saw such revelation. These students, suddenly they could see, and they kept saying, why didn't you let us come out here and talk like this at the first of the term?
Really? Yeah, I can see where they.
Yeah.
Oh, and they just.
You see, all I was interested in is making contact with Ms. Rawlins and those people. And, you know, it's a right complicated thing. It's very simple. It seems to be so difficult. You simply have to get into them, and then you've got to talk to people like they talk with.
Right. Otherwise, you don't understand.
Yes, and then it's very simple.
Yes, it is. It is very simple, actually. But when you're first getting into it and you've never been exposed to it, it's very difficult, you know, because it's another world.
And you see, as long as you're wrapped up in all that foolishness over there on the campus, it's a barrier. Except, you see, there's none of that in these people.
No.
That's a way of life that they don't follow.
Striking, you mean?
Well, it's so emotional, and so you see, so hipped.
But you see, there are so many things on a wider scale that need to be done that they are involved in. That they are part of this sphere just as much as I am.
But you haven't looked at things from that point of view.
No.
You have you look at them from the street and say, yes, you're all tied up and stuff. You ought to be out here with us. But you never looked at it from that point of view. You've got no notion of what's in their mind.
Just like Bruce.
Yes, but I
you've got one little glimpse of Bruce, mm-hmm. but that's all. And that was cockle brain.
What's that mean?
You see, your whole thesis, your whole direction there, just close the door. I'm just talking to you now.
Oh, I know.
I'm not trying to win. I'm just working. With
You're winning, but go ahead.
I'm not either. That stone industry.
No. Now, you see, if you was on my staff, I don't have a staff.
No, I know. And I need a job.
Yeah. If you was on my staff, we'd go around and talk to those people in the office and see. We wouldn't talk to them about the war. Wouldn't necessarily talk to them in the office. But we'd talk to them, or they'd talk, and we'd kind of see.
Yeah.
And look, some of the lightning bugs on the way.
Yeah. See my insect collection.
You had to have a collection?
Oh, I have to have. Oh, well, that's not all I've got to have. I have had to observe a cricket for 8 weeks. I mean, 8 weeks, and tell what that cricket does. And I don't know what it does. You know, I say it moves here, it moves there. But he doesn't want you to give it any human characteristics. Don't call it her and don't call it him. Call it it. And I just. You know, I'm observing this cricket, but I just don't know why.
Where do you have your cricket?
On my shelf. In a jar. I feed it dog food and sometimes lettuce.
A cricket. A cricket ought to be.
But my first one died and I cried. I really did. And that was a mistake to tell Dr. Lloyd that, because he told me I was displaying anthropomorphism again. I thought, oh, God, no.
Is that the cricket little box?
Well, no, it's a jar. The school gave us, you know, the entomology. A big jar, and it's got a water bottle that it drinks out of, and you put sand on the bottom of it and dog food and a top with holes in it.
And he's all right. It's all right.
And it's all right. It just runs around.
Yeah.
I guess it likes being in there, but it's in there.
You ought to put three in there.
Orgy.
Put three in there, you wouldn't have to feed none of them.
Yeah.
Two of them would survive off the other, and they would kill it. And survive off of the other.
Yeah. And just, yeah.
I will.
No, this term is really bad.
How much we would do then?
He's fine. He's showing me his dog.
They're beautiful, aren't they?
They sure are. He has new litters. They're about that big.
What are you doing, Faye?
Nothing. I thought we were still coming. Talking about the dog. One of them won't bark at me now.
Just one?
Yeah, well, no, wait, let's see there.
They're barking me.
There's the female and then the Dan in the front yard, and all four puppies play with me.
Oh, and really?
Yeah, and the one.
Oh, yeah,
so
the little puppies.
Yeah, the little ones. Oh,
yeah.
They're big now.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
But the Dan, the one he's got out in the front, that tan and white one, he introduced me to him last week. You know, let me pet him, so now he won't bark at me when I come to the yard.
Oh.
He won't come up to us, Mr. Weaver. Yeah, of course. So.
But he won't bark.
Oh, he won't.
No. He'll come out and look at me.
Yeah.
But if Mr. Weaver's standing listening, he'll come on up all the way and he'll let me pet him.
Oh, really?
But on that, he just kind of stands back a little bit.
Well, that's like my guy ever let me get him.
He's got one female dog that doesn't like him to pet him. You know, she just had puppies. And he said that she dragged all eight puppies underneath her house and rolled on them and killed six of them.
Mm-hmm.
And she keeps going under there. So he goes out and he drags her out from under the house and reattaches the chain, puts the puppies back in the house. And the dog stands there and watches him. Well, we were at both out there, and she just kind of stood back and kind of kept an eye on him. And wouldn't let him pet her and wouldn't let me pet her. And he says, because she wasn't raised right, when she was a puppy. He says that she thinks she has to steal her food.
Oh.
And when he, of course, she's out way by herself. But he says she just is scared of people. He says, now, you didn't notice those four puppies in the pen doing that, did you? I said, no, because when Carol and I were out there feeding them, he had one big bucket. And he had it about half filled with food. And he just walked in the pen, and all four dogs, about 6 months old, just stuck their heads in and started eating all together. Gulp, gulp, gulp. You know, he stopped, just take a bite and swallow it. So he got one of them, and he pulled him apart. He said, this one eats faster than the rest of them, so he has to keep him away. And let the other three eat, and then let this one in after they've eaten it, almost their fill, and let this other dog.
I never had any luck letting any animals eat together.
Well, these horses out here, you sure can't. Can't feed the colts, the crept oats. That's what gets in their throat for some reason. That's what I'm feeding them.
Really?
They're all right on the almond. Georgia. Our Jim's folks are going to Georgia. They're moving back there. His dad was raised there for a while until he's 15, and now they're moving back up to a different place. And they bought some land up in the hill country, above Atlanta. I told you in the car.
Yeah.
And they're going to build a house and build fences and pens and chicken coops and gardens and just kind of buy a cow, for milk, and one for beef, a couple of hogs, and some goats. And that's cause I mentioned one night at dinner, I heard that if you kept goats around, it'd keep horses from getting distemper. I don't know if it's true or not, but.
You ever hear that?
No.
Well, you can pull a card anyway. And barbecue goat's good to eat, too. And we're going to have, what is it, brown guinea hens, Jim? Brown guinea hens, I think. Cause
I didn't know about
them. Don't you know when your grandparents were talking?
Yeah.
We're going to have chickens, of course. Nell wants chickens to eat. And I think we're going to have guinea hens. Because anybody comes up, they'll cackle real loud or something. I'll warn you that they're around.
Oh, they do, yeah. I wish I had some.
There's brown ones, and then there's some other kind, Grandfather said. And he said, but the brown ones are best, because anytime they see anybody, they just set off. And I said, well, why don't you get a peacock? They're really making that noise. Grandfather said, no, he said, peacock, they're awful. He said, you wake up and hear them, you screaming at you, and drive you crazy. So here goes the peacock.
I don't know what a peacock does. Do they sound off when somebody comes
up?
Yeah.
They're supposed to. They get out in the trees. They hear somebody.
Yeah.
But they got a real ugly sound. Loud, scream sort of sound. And I thought, well, we could have a goose. Butte didn't want a goose. Because when he was young, they used to chase him and pinch him. So he don't want a goose around. So, and let's see, what else? They're planning on having some horses. Our horse, Bubba. And one for Faye. And a pony for their nephew. He's three. I think we're supposed to build him a little pony cart. Might hit the goat up for that. But anyway, they're gonna build a house. Kind of settle in and live up there. Raise vegetables.
And they want the land.
Yeah, they want the land. It's pre-land, too. It's hill, mostly.
Yeah.
And woods.
Well, what's that fella got to do with it that got you out of the... pulled you out when you got stuck? You bought the land from him.
Bought the land from his sister.
Yeah.
Husband.
Yeah.
From that man's sister?
Husband.
Yeah, she had about, she had a bunch of land.
Wasn't it 7,000 acres? No, not that.
Several hundred acres.
It's his sister. He's lived in that house that we saw, a great big old one, bigger than this house, so the kind of porch that goes along all three sides.
Oh, really?
It has an enormous house. I guess it's two stories with some gables and all on the top. Big old white houses. The side porch we went on, I think it had about three screen doors. We didn't know which one to knock at. So we knocked both of them.
Is that an old family house of that, or you just recently?
It must be, because he said he's raised there, wasn't he?
He raised there.
He's raised there. And it's 70 years old.
Well, that's nice.
So it must be family. Evidently, the sister married somebody who had a lot of money.
Oh.
That bought the land a long time ago.
Oh, yeah.
Now, he said he'd worked the land when he was a boy. And cotton and corn, all that land that was cleared, but he didn't say whether his family owned it or not. He just worked it.
Yeah.
But I guess maybe his family owned it. So he's a carpenter, but he raises cattle and farms too, I guess.
Well, does he act like the gentry or just a carpenter?
I don't know. He's scaring me the first time I heard him. He's, you know, he's real tall, raw bone sort of people. You know, gaunt, dark black hair, and bony face, deep set eyes. He had on a pair of white overalls, I guess. He'd been working. I don't know what, I don't think he'd exactly be a gentry.
Yeah. But he can work. He got tractors and all that.
Oh, yeah.
And filling his boys.
Yeah, he had, saw, yeah, the boys, it's funny, they're real pale looking. And they all look like him, kind of bony, mostly. Except the littlest boy, and he was 5 and still had his baby fat and all. He had kind of, they all had this real funny looking nose, and it's long, kind of beak-like. And even the little boy, you know, and usually babies like that, their noses are just kind of, you don't see them too much. But you can notice his. But the oldest boy that we saw, you know, his ankle bones showed, and his wrists were all bony, and his elbows kind of stuck out. 13, 14, I guess.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like a rather promising neighborhood.
Yeah.
I guess some work out of it.
You might.
You get stuck. They got stuck. You
sure pulled us out, thank goodness. I don't know how long we were stuck there. It must have been 2.5-3 hours. Cold, you know, it's been snowing.
Is that George's place?
Now, where does the Western music come in now? I haven't heard anything about that in so long. Has Bill and the family quit playing that?
Have they?
They don't play it when we're home too much, because Suzanne don't like it.
I never said I didn't like it.
Well, I don't know. They don't play it too much anymore, I don't think.
If they do,
when we're home.
They've been taping it for Jim.
He taped one tape for me, one particular one, and taped some instrumental guitar for me. Jimmy Rogers, all the Jimmy Rogers, but he hadn't bought any more records, got any more into them. Well, the impression I got was that Joe played it all the time as soon as he got home.
Saturday nights, he'd watch on TV, and he puts it on Saturday morning when he get up.
Yeah.
He just turns it on, you know, while we're reading the paper and getting breakfast, you know. But now, we end up talking so much, you know, at the supper table, and that lasts a long time. Then we go in the living room and talk.
You got all this talk about it, don't you?
Yeah. Sometimes you turn off the TV or tell Fade turn off and he'll put it on. But not too much anymore. We usually just end up talking.
Well, now, can you talk right through the TV?
Oh, yeah, we do it.
Yeah.
It's not too much that I don't think they pay much attention when they watch it. Except some programs.
No.
It's just on.
Just on.
Just, well, it's like our house. We have it on, but we don't. Just noise in the background. It doesn't stop anybody from saying what they want to say, and the conversation just kind of goes on. And sometimes they just go ahead and turn it off.
Yeah. Okay,
it could be Cookie has nothing to do. Good.
I have missed that. I went over a time or two to Louis Graham, and I didn't realize it was right nice, right in there. And she had all those people there from all quarters, you see. She lives over on the other side of Macnoke. And she's one of these public spirited people. She's not doing one thing, she's doing another. And that's about as harmless as you could do. And she had this Westminster, and she got to the point, see, where she was having a grand ole opry, or what they call it, Jim.
That's it.
Grand ole opry.
Yes. She would have one of the grand ole opries somewhere. I think that's the wrong word.
Well, everybody called it Grand Ole Opry, but really the only Grand Ole Opry is in Nashville.
Yeah.
You know, and the rest
but
of
she'd have Cookie's children, and Helen were in it over there at Butler's.
Oh, Johnson.
Johnson's schoolhouse.
Oh yeah.
Time or two, wasn't it?
Yeah, quite a few times. They went to Lake City. I mean, up to Swanee State Park one Saturday evening.
Yeah. Now, what do they call that? Just Western music?
Just Western music.
Yeah. And see, they all performed. Just the residents, you know, just the people that live around there. They're not from way off, are they?
No, we had Loretta Lynn once out of Johnson.
Yeah. But by and large, it's just people
just
around.
Everybody's
around.
Like me.
Yeah. And I think they're supposed to make a little money off of it if they work it right.
Yeah, but we never did. It cost us money.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Cost you to perform. Yeah.
Yeah, I hear Mr. Weaver. He used to do it. He sing like it. He asked me when we were over there, he said, "Do you listen to the radio much?" I said, "Some." He says, "Well, I listen to it a lot." He says, "I get a station out of Nashville." And I said, "Oh, you mean you listen to the Grand Ole Opry?" And he says, "Well, yeah, that too." But he listens to all the programs that come out of there, all the country music, country spirituals. He looked at me. "I used to write music." He says, "I would have been good at it if I kept on."
Yes, yes, yes.
He used to sing second tenor. And he talked forever. What he did when he was young, he'd hear other people sing. So he decided he wanted to learn, and he went to a singing school that they have in the summer.
I never heard that.
No, I never did that.
He'd go to the singing school, and they have a teacher there, you know, with the theory books and all. And what they do, they put like four boys in a group, just the male quartet. And each boy would have to write in his part, the bass or the alto or the tenor, or whatever the other part is. And Mr. Weaver said, his teacher told him one time, he says, "Now, don't you tell the other boys this." said, if you get back to their parents, then the parents would be upset with me. He said, you're about the best one in this group. Because we would write in the tenor part. He said, that's called harmony. He said he used to think he wasn't very good at it. He thought the other boys were a lot better than him until the teacher told him that he was the one who really knew what he was doing. So he kept writing music, his parts, and then he bought himself an organ. He saved up the money, and he got an organ, $125, the best one he could find. And he took the organ home, and he couldn't play it. He said his fingers, something wrong with his fingers. They were weak in the joints or something like that. I guess from playing baseball. He did that too. And he learned to play the organ a little bit because he knew that an organ hit the note true. Not like a piano, he said. Piano, you don't get the right note. But an organ, you get just exactly the note you want. And he'd practice. He'd hit the organ note and then he'd sing it. And so when it come time for him to be in a contest, I guess it's like a spelling bee or one of these things, you know, where just everybody from all over the county just comes in and listens. He'd always be right in the best group because he could read the music and sing it, you know, just right on the notes. But he said, he looked at me, he says, you're going to laugh at this. I said, I'm going to laugh. He said, well, he said, I used to hear how people would give talks, would watch themselves in a mirror. He said, that's called expression. He said, so I decided I'd try that. He said, I'd sit in front of a mirror and sing and watch himself. And he said, that's one reason why everybody liked to hear me sing, because I could put so much expression in it, because he's practicing.
That's not a bad idea.
But he said he sang second tenor, the highest. And one contest he remembered especially, some man wrote a song, and everybody around said, well, nobody's going to be able to sing that. He said, that song's just too hard for this contest. Because it had, I guess it was the high A above staff. Or maybe it was a B. I think it was a B. And he said, nobody could sing that. Well, Mr. Weaver got his two brothers and another fellow lived in the neighborhood, and then Mr. Weaver. And they got to the contest, and Mr. Weaver said, well, I can sing that. We can sing that song. And I said, no, you can't sing it. So he said that whole church was just full. Just everybody from all over that heard about this song in the contest. They all came to see if they'd be able to sing it. He said they got up there, and sure enough, they sang it just the way it was written. With expression. So he still listens to it. He said he had to quit because he got in an automobile accident and messed up his cheekbone and his jawbone. And the sound wouldn't come out right after that. But he still listened. And then after a while, he got to be a judge at the contest. And he said the singers, I guess they're mostly younger ones, would come up and ask him, well, what did we do wrong when we sang the song? And he said, well, what book did you use? You know, in the school where you learn harmony, you know. And he mentioned three books. I forgot the name of them. He said they were just pretty much standard. And he'd ask them which book they used. And they'd tell him, well, it's Thrall or whatever. And he'd say, he'd tell them what they did wrong according to the way Thrall would write it in his book. He said, because they use different words when they're talking about the same thing in different books. He said, so he'd have to know what book they'd learned from in order to tell them what they'd done wrong. So he knew all the books. He just didn't know which one they knew. And he'd tell them what they'd done wrong with.
Now, when did you all go into this, Susan?
Last week.
Oh.
She's been keeping it all week.
He went into that. And I know how it came up. The dog was taking my shoelaces apart. And he just looked at me and asked me if I listened to the radio much. I said, yeah, I listen a little.
That was an opening for him to tell you.
That's all it was.
That's all it was. I know. I told him, I said, Jim's family listens, and I listen with him, and I've gotten to like it.
Yeah.
And then he started talking about it.
So you didn't scotch him right off.
You kidding?
Yeah.
Well, if it had been me, I'd say that damn radio has got so it's just noise.
And that'd be the end of that.
Yeah.
I was about ready to leave, and he said, "There's something else I want to tell you." I waited, and he said, "This low blood pressure," he says, "it gets me back here, and it makes it hard for me to remember things because it makes my back to hurt, and then makes my neck and head. No, I can't think straight." He said, "That's why I wandered so much to not use over here. He couldn't tell things straight because his back was hurting him. He didn't feel good." He said, "But there's something I was going to tell you." And he sat there against the car a little while and he thought. He said, "I know what it was." He says, "When I was working in Birmingham for a lumber company, and they're going to have a big spelling bee for the whole city. And not for the kids, but for the men. You know, they'd been out of school for years and years. And so everybody in the lumber company wanted him to represent their company." He says, "No, it's been too long since I was in school." But they finally talked him into it. He said there must have been 50 people in the contest. He said, well, he knew he wasn't going to last long because it's been so long since he'd been in school. He said, "But I decided I'd just pay real close attention, you know, and just concentrate." He says, "That's what you have to do. You have to concentrate." He says, "So I listen to each person spell the word, and I think about it, and I concentrate." And he looked at me. He says, "Guess how I ended up?" I said, "Mr. Weaver, knowing you, you probably were first." He laughed. And he said, "No, I was third. I have 50 people."
I never heard, I thought I'd do that before.
It's a first.
Time to get back into it.
You mean you didn't get out?
No, it's just been out.
All right, let's see that Frank out there. He wants something.
Anyway, what made him mad, he lost on an easy word. He said he'd spelled all those hard words, and they gave him an easy one, and he didn't think. He just spelled it without thinking. And he said he missed it. And so the other two fellas won second or first.
So you'll have to know Mr. Weaver.
Fantastic.
Isn't that amazing?
But he told me a couple of times while I was there, he said, "When I was a boy," he said, "I've always been this way, and I always will." He says, "I want to be as good or better than the next man doing something." And he sets out to do it.
Well, what he does, you see, he just looks. Watch this. I've heard him say again and again and again, you see. He don't just sit there with his mind vacant. He just, that's where he learned how to barber. He just watched the man do it and then tried to do it himself. Well, if he does that, he don't need to go to school, does he?
No.
It's a better school.
Experience.
He's about as fine a case of that as I've ever seen. Yeah.
He told me, he says, "Now, going to school is fine. College is fine." He says, "But," he says, there's nothing like experience." He says, "When I was a boy, I'd experiment with things, and I'd try new things out, and I'd try to talk my dad into trying new things. You know, they suggestions in a catalog. Dad wouldn't do it, and he wanted to." He said, "So when I got a farm, I went ahead and tried all those things.
Yeah.
And I'd watch how somebody do it, and I'd read how they do it, and then I'd do it." He said,
yeah.
And he says, "You just don't do that when you're in college too much anymore."
No.
He says, "I'm not downgrading school." He says, "I think that's fine. It's just experience."
Wonder what he'd do in college.
He's probably going to have a valedictorian. He decides he's going to do better than anybody else.
Because he's firmer.
Yeah.
He'd be running the baseball team, probably. And singing.
Yeah.
He'd been able to doctor himself with that blood pressure because he studied chiropractor back in the 20s when people were talking about that so much. Some people around town there talking about going to chiropractor. He said, well, he's just going to see what there was to it. So he went to the chiropractor down to Ocala, and he went two times. And he learned everything the chiropractor knew.
Too dumb.
And the chiropractor said, well, he used to hit and come back up ahead of him. And you talk about, he did it.
It's the truth.
I sat right over there. And he operated on me.
And got you.
And I have never had any confidence in chiropractors or curiosity or interest, especially when they pop my bones. He popped me right fast. And he did more than that. I forget what he did, but he was agile. And his hands are just like steel. He keeps telling, you know, about handling those horses, Cookie. And you wonder how in the world he does that. He'd take them by the nose and hold them, you see, while somebody got on. Well, it takes a man with pretty good muscle to do that, don't it?
Sure does.
And you got to stick your heel somewhere. And he's so meek looking.
Yeah,
but he don't talk meek, he just quiet. And he don't talk big. He's not like Arkansas. He's not a...
No, he doesn't brag. He just...
Not a rowdy, you see.
You just find out that he's got the best dogs in the state. He's the best barber around. He's the best singer he ever was in that area.
But as frail as he is, his body is just like steel, and his abdomen down here.
Oh, it's
just
hard.
You can just, he said, yeah, I just ran it.
Yeah.
And it's that sort of thing. He really is.
And he stays in shape, right now. He don't wash his dishes every day. Is he going to
do it?
He don't.
We sat on the porch today.
Last time I was over there, he said he was just cleaning up and washing dishes.
He said he's just getting ready to shave. His nephew and niece came over and just kind of threw him for a loop, I think. They came and they wanted his pliers. And I thought, pliers? I was going to say, whether they're saying pliers or a plow, you know, and he said, no. He says, you take it and you'll put it down and I won't ever have it again. They wanted him to fix his bike. So they crawled all over him and all over the puppy and all over his sports. They finally just gave up and fixed their bike for him. So then he went off. He says, now why do you wait till I've got company before you come over and bring this stuff to me?
Oh, that's why he was hanging.
He fixed it and sent them off.
Yeah. Now, he traded horses, because he traded a little other thing. And he's had... Have you heard him?
I've never met him.
You know him? Well, he comes over here and we have hair cutting.
Yeah?
He just talks just like the old barbers used to talk.
Oh.
That's an education, right there, ain't it? Yes,
sir.
And the nice thing about it, he'll tell you about it. Anything he knows about, he'll tell you about it.
Yeah.
You going to work your horses?
No, I'm going to get the children some food.
Or get them some.
If you Suzanne, you're going to fry some.
I've got to go and see what Frank wants.
Sure. I'll tell you.
Going twice.
Yeah.
Y'all go on outside. We'll let Lorraine.
You want your car?
Suzanne and I'll fix a picnic in a minute.
You don't want me to help you?
Oh, this is your first time using
I can
use it later today.
I'll take Lorraine.
You take Lorraine out.
Where are you going to take me? Do I have to do anything? I haven't eaten in 12 hours, for God's sake.
You look at him.
Breakfast?
I had a piece of toast.
Is that right? No.
You're a cracker.
You're a piece of bread.
Dr. Miles, you handed back those tests, didn't you, Wednesday?
LBB?
Those other tests that we had.
I've got this big one here.
Did I fail?
I got another big one here. Mr. Weaver's telling me how to plant sweet potatoes, too. I thought I'd ask. He offered me some jars, vines. He said, just come on over here, and you can take all you want. He's got a few.
He talked about all those things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He's
fun.
Bird dogs,
fox
pounds,
trading.
Lorraine, yeah. I'm hungry too. Let's just get going.
Let me tell you, you know the brown girl who was in my group outfit last summer? You never ran into her. She's the one that had a Newfoundland dog and couldn't find a place to live. Or is that the big dog you found?
Yeah,
St. Bernard,
yeah, it's a great big thing. And she wrote it, she's in journalism, she wrote it. There's a picture of her and her dog. That's the early part of this year. And I don't know whether she's still here or not. I think she's finished. Anyhow, I kept wanting to stick her on to Mr. Weaver. Because she knows dogs, you know, had a little field for dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And she's in journalism. And she worked with me and read the same, you know, same thing you're reading, except she read the infant side of it. Mm-hmm. And she took right to it. And she never missed class.
Would you cut that out? See? I have missed maybe two or three.
This must be Channel 2 over Sunday afternoon with Lorraine Bassetta and Suzanne. Lorraine finishing up her narrative of the strike, and Suzanne reporting on her visit with Mr. Weaver. The Sunday, the 30th of May, 1971. This must be Channel 2 over around 900, something or other, whatever it is. I'll just see you in a minute.